Representative Anderson, but we do have a quorum, and we can form a subcommittee as needed. However, this is sufficient to start the committee. We will begin this morning. Let's see, while we wait for the chair, maybe we take counsel from staff. Sandy?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I just have one announcement to make, and the chair is here. The chair was going to announce that House Bill 2058, the amendment that was presented by Representative Crummell during our public hearing, is not yet ready, so it is the chair's hope to hold that over until that amendment's ready.
Okay, we'll turn the gavel back to the chair now that he's here.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
Great. We will open a work session on House Bill 2053. Sandy will reacquaint us with 2053.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. House Bill 2053 had a public hearing on the 11th of February. You may recall that this bill merely changes the name of the Oregon Commission for Voluntary Action and Services to the Oregon Volunteers Commission for Voluntary Action and Service. It also increases the membership of the commission. There is no fiscal, there is no revenue.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I move House Bill 2053 to the full House with due fast recommendation. And I will further make a recommendation. We put it on the consent calendar, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Great recommendation. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2053 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes, sir.
Representative Greenlink.
The commission was kind enough to provide me with a list of the names of the commissions across the 50 states, and there is no consistency whatsoever. They have all sorts of names. Most of them do include volunteerism. I still want to put on the record, I think, the name, making the name more complicated by adding volunteerism rather than adding volunteerism and shortening the name is an error, but I haven't decided yet how I'm going to vote. I suppose I have to soon. Huh?
Mr. Chair.
Butler.
Mr. Chair, I would remove my recommendation that we move this to the consent calendar if the good representative from Northeast Portland. I can say Northeast Portland. Most of them, right? With most,
no, it's
not more.
You're not even close. It's
Southwest.
Northwest Portland, west to North Plains.
I would remove it if Representative Greenlake would like me to be able to speak in opposition.
No, I don't think it's important enough to do that, and I will vote for it coming out. As I pointed out, the volunteers who are involved in this commission made a decision. I just think the name would have been simplified by simply making the volunteer the commission on volunteers or something, but I will vote for this and go along with
Thank
it.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I won't remove my request that this be moved to the consent calendar on that. I call for the question.
See, I can make up my mind quickly.
That question has been called. Is there any objection? Cook, I'll call the roll. House Bill
2053.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Greenwood?
Aye.
Representative Mayne?
Aye.
Representative
Butler?
Aye.
And Chair
Belko? Chair votes aye. House Bill 2053, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
For the public record, would you like to show that Representative Anderson is excused?
Thank you, Representative Butler. For the record, Representative Anderson is excused for the time being on House Bill 2053. We will allow him to enter a vote when he returns to the committee. He's testifying. Representative Butler, do I have a motion for the consent calendar?
I so move that 2053 be moved to the consent calendar, Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler moves House Bill 2053 to the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Any objection? House Bill 2053 is placed on a consent calendar. Yes.
Just as a footnote, Mr. Chair, thank you. Members, you all had attached to the SMS the information that Representative Greenlink referred to about the name change and the other 50 states, just so you know that you have that information also. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Sandy.
I like Minnesota. Serve Minnesota.
I saw that. So that was interesting. Okay, we will open a work session on House Bill 2177. Sandy?
Mr. Chair, Again, House Bill 2177, we had a public hearing on that bill on the 11th of February. This authorizes the State Board of Clinical Social Workers to develop rules that establish the license and certificate renewal date from an annual to a birth month renewal process. It modifies the conditions for imposing a delinquent renewal fee and lapse of certificates and licenses, and it declares an emergency and is effective upon passage. Again, excuse me, Mr. Chair. Our fiscal impact says it's minimal, but there is no dollar impact on this, so, and there's no revenue impact.
Is there a subsequent referral?
No, Mr. Chair. There is none.
Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Question, was there any discussion regarding the State Board of Clinical Social Workers to move their licensing to a biennial and odd years if they're born in an odd year, or even years if they're born in an even year, on their month of birth?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that topic was not discussed, but they are here if you would like to address the question to them.
Mr. Chair, many committees are moving in this direction. Many of the agencies, state agencies, are moving in this direction. Oregon has its budget prepared on a biennial basis. The Ways and Means process is set up so that they can do a 24-month analysis with a 48-month and reverse, as well as a 72 and forward. And this would certainly reduce the overall cost by having people, having licensees of the board pay for and subscribe to their licenses 2 years at a time. Also, fees can be prorated when they design and decide to increase fees. They can prorate based upon each month. So this is something we work towards in the Ways and Means process in the state. Just wondering where the State Board of Clinical Social Workers have been relative to this issue.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Can we call the State Board forward? John Langenwalter. Good morning.
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, members of the committee. The board has talked about this issue in the past and so far is still opposed to moving to a biannual renewal. For one basic reason, in our annual renewal, we ask all sorts of questions about how are you doing in your practice? Are you still effective in your practice? Have you had any DUIs in the last year? And the board's consensus is that to do that every 2 years doesn't give us enough feedback from the field. So we still want to hear from everybody once a year and feel that that's still appropriate.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, to Ms. Langwalter's response, I have at least one license which I subscribe to from the state as a certified public accountant, and if the State Board of Accountancy wrote me and asked if I was still effective in my practice, I would probably say yes, even when I haven't filled my own tax return out for the last 3 years. So I guess my response to that would be yes. With regard to the DUIs, my response to that inquiry would be that it would be the responsibility, and you should do that by rule, that any one of your licensees who receives a DUII without having to wait 12 months or 16 months for the renewal process to take place, they ought to write and tell you when they receive a DUI and give you the circumstances so that the board could act on it if you feel appropriate, as opposed to waiting that long period of time, because a problem with drinking, drugs, gaming, those kinds of things can show up and create problems. And I don't know that I just limit DUIs, and I'm sure that you don't. Other criminal activity that they may have been engaged in that they've been convicted or charged with accordingly. So I don't know that I buy that as a reason why we should continue to move the State Board of Clinical Social Workers off in this particular fashion. Mr. Chair, if we don't feel like it's appropriate to address the situation here with regard to the current renewal information, my request would be that that the chair authorize and issue a letter to the Ways and Means co-chairs and ask the co-chairs, when they hear the budget for the State Board of Clinical Social Workers, that they actually put a budget note in there to have them address the issues, not to have the softball questions, are you effective in your practice, but have them address the questions relative to anything such as the DUIs or other kinds of activity that they may have, that any of the licensed social work folks have been engaged in, that they have been convicted of or accused of crimes or those kinds of things, and then that they move, that the Ways and Means process assist in moving the licensing period to save these folks a lot of money. because if you don't have to go through this process with everyone every year in relicensing them, but have them by rule send information to the board relative to their continuing professional education hours or their other kinds of professional activities and how they're doing in their overall demeanor, then I personally believe that their licenses will end up costing them less to practice and that the state will be better served in the long run.
All right, Representative Butler, we'll take that under advisement. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to clarify whether our vice chair has put on the record that he hasn't filled out his taxes for the last few years.
Mr. Chair, I have filed my taxes, but I have not prepared them myself.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I've got my appointment with H&R Block very shortly.
Is that your wife, Representative Butler? Mr. Langenwalder, do you have a response?
Could I please?
Please.
Chair Donaldson, Representative Butler. I don't have the renewal form in front of me, but there are 8 specific questions that we ask, and those are legal questions every year. It is in rule that if a person does have a court case against them that relates to their practice, they're supposed to let us know, quote, immediately, unquote. And if they have a DUI or something like that, they're supposed to let us know. Our experience is that sometimes people aren't aware of that particular rule and will hear about it in the renewal process. Oh yeah, I did get a DUI. And then we'll go and find out if they're impaired and if they need to take some action so that they can still serve the public effectively. So that is in rule already. It's just not followed completely well.
Mr. Chair, I don't know that I even need to respond to that. If it is in rule that immediate response or notification is required, and the board is not demanding it of their licensed clinical social workers, then really I'm wondering just how effective this whole process is. But again, Mr. Chair, one possibility is that we could defer this particular piece of legislation, 2177, over to a later date and see if we could rework it. But I don't know that that's the best, that this even has a relating clause, because this really relates to the authority of the state's Board of Clinical Social Workers. My thought is that again, we could go ahead and begin to stand on their air hose down in the Ways and Means process and make sure that they examine the process of getting their license renewals done on a more frequent or on a regular basis and complying with the required internal notification, which, as the executive director indicates, is an immediate requirement but may not be totally complied with by their licensees.
Mr. Chair, does this... May I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Tormey.
Does this bill have a subsequent referral to another committee?
It does not.
So this would go from our committee to the floor?
It would.
Correct.
Mr. Chair, do you have the capacity of putting a subsequent referral in?
No, let me think right here.
Representative Butler, it's not my desire to do that at this point, but if you want a little bit of time to attend to the issues that you bring forward, we can maybe slow it down a little bit.
Mr. Chair, either general government or Health and Human Services Ways and Means process will have the State Board of Clinical Social Workers, I would think, appearing before them. That being the case, I would like an opportunity to go ahead and take House Bill 2177 off of today's calendar without further notification time right now, with the idea that we'll get together with our with the chairs of the committee or the chair of the committee where this will be heard in the Ways and Means process, make sure that the Ways and Means process has at least a budget note and that budget note coordinates with this activity, because as we authorize the rules for the licensees to change the renewal date in this legislation to their birth date, to their birth month on an annual basis, as far as I'm concerned, that's a half of a step where they should be taking the full step, and that is to change it to their birth month in the even year or the odd year in which they were born, so that you move to a biennial license. Again, that's what the majority of our agencies are attempting to do that are licensing other professionals in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair.
President Greenlich.
There are basically two things being discussed here. One is, actually three things. One is the ability to move to a birth month, which is in this bill, which is a step forward in increases in the efficiency. Then there's the question of moving to biennial licensure. And then there's the third question of certification of the continued competency because of a variety of issues. My suggestion is we pass this bill and ask ways and means, not about only about social work, but to put in budget notes for all the agencies to suggest they move to biennial, and that's clearly a ways and means issue, to suggest they move to biennial rather than annual licensing. And I think if that was done between this session and next session via a budget note, that would be an advance, and I do agree that biennial budgeting, biennial licensing makes a lot more sense. I suggest we do move this bill, get the process started so it gets on a monthly basis, and deal with the biennial one in a separate process, or perhaps even in a Senate amendment, which they might consider and offer when it gets to the Senate.
Patrick Allen in the audience. Patrick, perhaps you have a perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Patrick Allen, I manage the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. We have a bill in the House General Government Committee right now that addresses this excellent issue that Representative Butler raises. There are about 300 different licenses the state issues that are one-year licenses. House Bill 2094 provides broad authority for agencies to offer extended license terms to its licensees if doing so is consistent with the reason for the licensing. The example I use, there are places where it wouldn't be, amusement park rides, where you want the thing looked at once a year to make sure it's safe. But there are a lot of licenses, as in this example perhaps, where maybe that's not necessary. Now, the approach that bill takes is permissive language. It authorizes agencies to make that choice, and then it authorizes them to offer those extended terms to their licensees rather than blanketly extending all license terms. It also goes longer. It authorizes extended terms up to 5 years. Now, given that there's a lot of things in that 300, those 300 licenses, contracting businesses and those kinds of things, that five-year term may not be appropriate for something like professional licensing, but it is an attempt to come at that same issue. And as I say, that bill is up in the General Government Committee right now.
Over there in Green Lake, do you have something to add? Okay. All right, we're going to move forward with this bill. So do I have a motion on this bill?
I so move, Mr. Chair, taking the recommendation of Representative Greenleaf into consideration that we encourage the Ways and Means process to look at this, and also receiving the input from the excellent input from Patrick Allen relative to regulatory streamlining and House Bill 2094. My hope is that 2094 receives good hearing, and that we encourage all of the agencies to do this, to streamline. But also, I think Representative Greenlick's caution that you know, we have some oversight of these agencies that have folks like the clinical social workers that might have DUI issues, that might have domestic relations issues that have risen to the issue of police calls and those kinds of things. But these are very important issues that are important to the people of the state of Oregon. So with that, Mr. Chair, if you would consider the possibility of encouraging, with your connections to the Ways and Means process as chair of this committee, with either the General Government Subcommittee or the Health and Human Services Subcommittee in Ways and Means, that would be an appropriate comment to make for their staff to at least look at this and other licenses for the two issues relative to streamlining and relative to the proper answering of the questions midterm on any of the kinds of issues. And that if folks are saying, yes, after 2 years that I had a DUI, but it was 23 months ago, then they need to take that action with their licensees at that particular point. But that's not an action that we would take at this time. It's something that, by rule and other statute, that you have the authority to act upon as an agency. With that, Mr. Chair, I move 2177 be moved to the full House of DuPass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2177 to the floor with a DuPass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Well, I'll just say to Representative Butler that I think we will take you up on your advice, and explore that further in the Ways and Means process.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
President Cameron?
Aye.
President
Greenway?
Aye.
President
May?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2177, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. We have a motion for the consent calendar.
So moved.
Representative May moves House Bill 2177.
Anderson excused.
Representative Anderson is excused.
Mr. Chair, I'm anxious about moving this to the consent calendar with the amount of discussion that's had on this. If necessary, I'll be happy to carry it or offer the new representative to carry it for us. So whichever.
Thank you, Representative Butler. I'll have you carry the bill.
Thank you.
Thanks. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2177. Open a work session on House Bill 2201. Sandy.
Again, Mr. Chair, House Bill 2201, we heard on the 11th of February. This is very similar to 2177. This authorizes the Oregon Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists to develop rules that establish a license renewal date and a late filing fee, filing grace period. Again, this board is looking to move from a January 1 renewal date to the birth month renewal process. And we do have the board administrator in the audience if you have questions.
Great.
Mr. Chair.
Discussion. Yes, Representative
Butler. Same issues that were previously raised with the Board of Clinical, Board of Clinical Social Workers, but it doesn't need to be, I think, rehashed. My concern would be that we proceed with this particular bill to the floor that we attempt to work through the issues with the Ways and Means process.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Butler. Looks like Representative Bruin stepped out of the room. She said what
she had a bill that she needed to testify on. Don't we still constitute a full committee?
Yeah. No, I just wanted her to have her not have an opportunity to vote on the bill.
I beg your pardon. She just indicated to me that she had a bill that she needed to testify on.
All right. Well, is there a motion on this bill?
I move that we send House Bill 2201 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2201 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Clerk will call the roll and note Representative Anderson and Representative Boone is excused.
Representative Anderson excused. Representative Butler?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Greenwood?
Aye.
Representative
Tomei? Aye. Chair votes aye. House Bill 2201, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed.
Mr. Chair, do you think that Representative Butler would allow this vote on the consent calendar?
I think, Mr. Chair, that if I could pattern my comments on 2177 in conjunction with 2201, that we could probably just go ahead and run it through the consent calendar.
Great. Then is there a motion?
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2201 to the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Is there Okay. Is there any objection? Well, then House Bill 2201 is moved to consent calendar.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules in the 22 that the vote 2201 by which it was passed that Representative Boone be authorized to go ahead and vote in favor of 20 or vote on 2201 if she's so favored.
Oh, I missed the vote. I thought it was going to be so fast.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Boone to vote on House Bill 2201. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Representative Boone, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Boone votes aye on House Bill 2201. Thank you. Now, okay. I think we're done with the work sessions. And we will, thank you, colleagues, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill, Senate Bill 2222A. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 222A engrossed comes to us from the Senate Health Policy Committee, comes to us with a 23-0 with one excuse and six legislative business votes. This defines multiple unit residential housing as housing that provides two or more living units, defines the single family housing in relationship to housing for people with chronic mental illness, allows the care providers of residents with chronic mental illness to occupy community housing. It also allows the Department of Human Services to sell or otherwise dispose of community property or community housing when it's no longer deemed suitable to use for housing.
Thanks very much, Sandy. We have Bob Repine, Bob Nickel, and Angela Kimball signed up. So we'll have you come forward, please. I'll let you guys decide who wants to go first.
Just Bill.
Okay. Good morning. Welcome, Bob.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Nickel. I'm the administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, which is in the Department of Human Services. And I'm here to testify, probably obviously, in support of Senate Bill 222. As has been described, this was introduced to deal with a couple of issues that we realized the 1999 bill as passed gave us some confusion about, particularly revising and clarifying definitions related to community housing. The changes that we've proposed make it possible to develop a full range of community housing rather than a narrower range of multiple unit residential housing that was in the original bill that passed. So specifically, this would allow the department to create treatment facilities, residential treatment homes, adult foster homes, and apartment complexes that have resident managers. The intent of our work in this area is not to dilute the original meaning of the bill, which is to primarily create housing for people with chronic mental illnesses, but to allow the department to create some certain types of specialized housing that we would not otherwise be able to create, which includes, in some occasions, allowing live-in resident manager or care providers. We've had a great deal of experience in working with these kinds of projects over the last 12 to 15 years. There are times when the housing project itself hinges on whether you have a resident provider there, particularly adult foster homes is probably a good example of that. The second part of the bill, as originally introduced, had to do with those times when possible that because of bankruptcy or default, a housing project that we developed is no longer usable. Now, often what happens is another provider is willing to step in. We've had that happen in the Portland area with some of the projects. So, but this is in the very rare occasion, frankly, where a provider goes bankrupt. This would allow us to sell the property, but it does go back to the housing, the community mental health housing fund, so that we don't lose the value of the property. We're able then to work with the Housing and Community Services Department, for example, to find alternative uses. One additional change that we worked with in the Senate at our suggestion was to modify the multiple unit residential housing definition so that we could develop duplexes or triplexes. As the original bill read, it would have allowed us only to do fourplexes. We had a recent example, I think just in the last week, up in the Gorge, where a community project, because it was larger and was going to serve people from outside the community, we were not able to get approval of the community to do that project. I think this illustrates the concern that sometimes small is much better. So having the option of developing a duplex, as the Senate Bill 22A would allow us to do, is the reason for that. So I would be happy to answer any questions, but that's a summary of the testimony that you have in writing.
Great. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make certain with Mr. Nickel that this would not in any way, it seems to actually enhance housing opportunities for those folks who have who are in housing facilities for the chronically mentally ill. This wouldn't in any way change where we had those folks presently living in homes that had head care providers in the home, it would actually facilitate those, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that is correct. It would enhance our ability to do that, but it wouldn't cause us to change any projects that we've already developed.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to acknowledge and thank these folks from Housing and Mental Health, the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, for bringing forward this bill for us.
Great. Thank you very much, Representative Butler, for your comments. Who's next? Bob or Angela?
Chair Dalto and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. The association is here in strong support of the engrossed version of Senate Bill 222, which we view as a vital tool in addressing the housing needs of individuals with serious mental illness in our state. And as the members of the committee are well aware, our state hospital is struggling to manage a burgeoning census in antiquated buildings, putting all involved at risk. With forensics admissions climbing steadily and a long wait for our civilly committed patients, there's increasing pressure to discharge clients to the community in order to open up scarce beds. But as the Governor's Mental Health Task Force report pointed out, a Department of Human Services survey from 2000 estimated that Oregon needed over 14,500 additional affordable housing units, with at least 2,567 housing units having supported services. In response to those needs, our community mental health programs have been working closely with the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services to develop a range of support housing as rapidly as possible. But unfortunately, current statute does not define community housing in a way that allows for single-family housing for at least three persons with chronic mental illness and for a care provider to be in residence, nor does it define multiple-unit residential housing to include housing with two or three units. This existing restrictive definition hampers our frontier counties where housing for individuals with serious mental illness is needed, yet the sparse population and limited resources make smaller single and multi-unit housing facilities much more viable. In our rural and urban counties as well, current requirements do not provide the flexibility needed to respond to local conditions and, even more importantly, to the needs of clients we serve. Take, for example, Ted, who came to me at the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill in Salem to talk about how, despite his paranoid schizophrenia, he very much wanted to work and live in a way that would be productive. He mentioned that he does better when he's with just a few people he trusts, though he hardly needed to say it. His eyes reflected intelligence and a gentle heart, yet darted nervously as he watched to see if people would approach. A worried mind, a harried heart, this is what his illness can do. We went to a quiet room to talk. He wants to plant seedlings in burned or logged areas or work in a nursery, somewhere outside, nurturing growth, where he isn't pressured by too many people. I mentioned that a Dr. Drake would be giving a lecture at Oregon Health Sciences University on the wisdom and effectiveness of the evidence-based practice called supported employment. And a few nights later, as I was walking out of the parking garage at Oregon Health Sciences University, a tall figure stepped silently out of the shadows. It was Ted. He found a way from Salem to Portland and had walked miles from the east side of the Willamette River, over the Hawthorne Bridge, and up the hills to OHSU. He walked in with me, but sat at the back of the lecture hall and slipped out noiselessly before the crowd would leave. He thanked me for telling him about the lecture and expressed once again his desire to live in a quiet home and have a job outdoors, where I imagine he finds some solace from the thoughts that pursue him. I nodded, then turned away and fought back tears as I realized the obstacles to his simple dream. This legislation would help overcome one of those obstacles by giving communities the flexibility to develop a wider array of housing for those with serious mental illness, including the kind of small single-family housing with a living care provider that might well be a good fit for Ted. We ask that you support the engrossed version of Senate Bill 222 so that we may more effectively and efficiently develop housing that eases pressure on the state hospital and, most importantly, provides dignity and the hope of recovery for the many individuals like Ted who come to us in need.
Thanks, Angela. Bob Repine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing Community Services, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Just not to repeat what you've heard before. I also am in support of Senate Bill 222 engrossed A. I think the comment that was made by the prior speaker really kind of sums it up. There's a need, based on a study, that over 14,500 affordable units are still needed in the state of Oregon. In our line of business, trying to meet those demands, to fulfill those needs, we know that in today's society, environments, and social thinking of our different communities, that one shoe doesn't fit all foot. And it's not uncommon to have a larger development in more of the upscale, urbanized areas, but in many of the rural communities, of which many of you represent, it is not uncommon to seek a single-family resident that's community environment, a neighborhood house, work with partners to take those that a three-bedroom house or and convert it to maybe making it a four-bedroom house with a small addition and an additional bathroom. So it really becomes a very community-oriented service component for the residents. In today's environments, from an economic standpoint, too, quite frankly, it is more cost-effective for us to consider those applications of housing. I don't have to tell you what the cost of housing is going for today, let alone on the current retail market, let alone what it costs to build it today. And so finding a well-constructed, as we say in our industry, a house that has good bones, take some consideration and bring it up to a standard that would improve both the quality of that house and the quality of the surrounding homes by reinvesting in those communities at a substantially less price. And then affording that same kind of residential environment for the residents is a very positive, good investment, both from this, from our perspective of finances, and I think from the investment of those people's lives. So we encourage this. What is stated in the bill is actually somewhat practiced in the state. We've been doing similar homes since the downsize of Fairview back in the early 90s, which we put over 2,000 of those houses, residents out in communities in residential house settings of five or less. So it really is consistent with that type of housing program that we've offered in the state for other populations.
Tim, thanks very much, Bob. I just want to say what a great job you guys are doing with housing for folks living with mental illness and developmental disabilities. It's great work, great bill. Representative Boone.
Two points. One was, how would it affect a house such as, and although it's not in my district, I was telling Representative Butler, but nearby in Astoria, they have a lot of pretty large Victorian homes, and sometimes they're split into separate living units, and they might share a common entry or whatever, but would that qualify?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, those kinds of projects are indeed the kind of projects that we've been working on, not necessarily in a Victorian house in Astoria, but we could work with that kind of project. What this bill does is tries to give us more flexibility. For example, if the housing need in that community was to have a residential treatment facility in a Victorian house, this would allow us to do that, whereas a strict interpretation of the 1999 law would not allow us to do this. So this indeed does open up some possibilities.
And how would it affect, for example, mobile homes or manufactured homes in a park or in a park setting or singly, whatever?
Maybe I'll check that one, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone, relative to financing, I think, becomes the critical issue. For us to instigate a long-term finance for a manufactured house and or in a park, particularly environment, we would have to be able to transfer fee simple title to the land, which the resident wouldn't have in most cases. So I would say it would probably preempt using a home in a park environment such as the one you described. However, it would not limit it to being a standalone residential manufactured housing that's been located in a community under the same principles of a stick built a conventional house would be.
Okay. Thank you.
President Greenland.
Thank you, sir.
Bob, I have a question that's slightly off, but I'm not sure it's entirely off. I had occasion to do a ride-along in an emergency room Saturday night and was appalled to find that in this emergency room, sometimes there'll be five or six patients with mental illness held because there's no bed, and some occasions held up to more than a week in a single room in an emergency room, and sometimes as many as six patients at this particular emergency room being held at one time. There were two yesterday one that had been there more than 48 hours. Will this do anything to help that? And is there anything on the way to help find a bed that will get those folks out of being essentially sedated in an emergency room until they can find a place for them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, yes, exactly. One of the reasons you're experiencing that and people are experiencing those kind of things in the community is that we are clogged up with getting discharges out of the state hospital. So, for example, at any given time, we've had as many as 20 to 40 patients in community hospitals waiting to get into the civil units of the state hospital. The way this is related is that if the more specialized, and often people leaving the civil commitment units in the state hospital cannot just be discharged to independent living situations. They need to be discharged to various kinds of residential treatment facilities. This allows us to use the housing trust fund in a way to create those very kinds of programs. So I know this is a little bit of a roundabout answer, but the answer is very much so. This allows us to do that. Now, our goal is always going to be able to create the most units per amount of money that we have, but we have to think about the needs of a variety of people in the system. Some people do need to live and can move into apartments, and we will continue to develop those kind of projects. That's always a factor in the evaluation of our housing applications that come in. But we do need the flexibility, and we need greater ability to create the very kinds of programs that would unclog the state hospital and unclog the community hospitals.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Representative Greenlee. Other questions or comments?
Okay.
Doesn't look like we have any. Thank you, ma'am, very much. Colleagues, we received some testimony from the Oregon Advocacy Center, and Bob Dundek, you should have a copy of that. Bob wasn't able to be here for this hearing, so I'd ask you to refer to that. And at this time, we would welcome Jane Loken, former representative from...
Thank you, Chair Dalton. And all of the members of the committee, and of course, having been the chief sponsor of House Bill 3446, which is the parent of this bill, I am pleased to see the attention that is being given, finally, to the needs of the mentally ill, and to trying to expand the way that we can treat them and help them, and to help them be accepted in the community. Because as we all know, there's been for many years, as long as I can remember, a stigma connected with having mentally ill in the neighborhood. So now we're working to correct that, and it's really... Well, it's gratifying to me to see the way that we are moving ahead. And I'm gratified at the expansion of the uses of the fund as expressed in Senate Bill 222. I do have a few concerns. I've been voicing them to Bob Nichols and other members on the Housing Committee. And our son has been... in a facility for years. He has drifted through many things. Independent living, which was a total disaster. He is schizophrenic. To Damish, committed there, finally. To Oregon Hospital for the Mentally Ill. And then to various foster homes, group homes, whatever they were called in Portland. Finally, he has been from... quite a number of years now at the Faulkner Place in Portland. I think that would be considered a group home. And that has been a wonderful situation for him and for us. To see your child constantly suffering, because they do suffer. Their mind is in turmoil, and he speaks of... living in hell. So we so desperately need the care, but there he has been so encouraged, because they find things for them to do, take them on little trips, and he gets into the therapy sessions now, which he never did before. So I can see how this work is progressing to help our so needy mentally ill. I have been concerned, of course. To me, the main thing is to spread the limited funds that come from the community mental health. Long name, trust fund, or housing fund, to as many beds as we possibly can. Because the need is so great, as Bob said, 14,500 units are needed right now. And a unit is not one apartment. I'm learning what a unit is, too. A unit is each area where you have beds, like a duplex is a unit. Okay, I have expressed a concern there about duplexes, that we spend the money very carefully, make decisions carefully, and I certainly commend the housing agency for and department for really working in this way, but we need to continue to do that because I think, for instance, just as an example, if we were to buy one-bedroom duplexes, I think that would not be as cost-effective. I would like to see at least two a unit, and that would be two bedrooms, undoubtedly, and most duplexes are, most triplexes are two-bedroom. And so all of these kinds of considerations, also for care providers, that this be monitored carefully so that this room, this space for care provider is for the care provider. I do not favor bringing in families to live there. That takes away beds from the mentally ill, and I'm a little hard-hearted about that. So I think these are things that need to be monitored, and we have talked about this as being a matters that can probably be resolved in administrative hearings, and I just wanted to alert you to the idea that we want to maximize to the greatest extent the use of our funds for the betterment of all of our chronically mentally ill. So that's my concern, and thank you, and I certainly will be talking with with Bob Nickel and others on the in the department as these matters progress and as they are heard in administrative hearings. So that's again, thank you very much for considering this bill and hopefully being favorable to it.
Thanks, Representative. Questions, discussion, Representative May.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a comment rather than a question. I just want to point out that Representative Loken has been a tireless and very effective leader for the mentally ill the years that she was in the legislature and probably before, but I wasn't aware of that, but certainly afterwards, too. She's a very effective voice for the mentally ill, and I thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further comments or questions? Representative Cameron.
This may be back to Bob or Jane. Maybe you can answer this. When you said units, and I'm looking at the bill, and it said include housing with two or more units, is that people, or is that?
I'm going to ask
because you brought up the word units.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, a unit as it's used in that term would be a duplex unit, which would be, I would assume, too, that it would usually be at least two bedrooms. And the question that could come up is, would there be one person in each bedroom or two? Our preference, again, is always to maximize resources. However, there could be a project that, takes people who really, really are not going to succeed in the community unless they're in a private room. And we've had quite a bit of experience with this. So I think the term unit applies to a duplex, which under most circumstances would have two bedrooms, but it doesn't get to that level of specificity in the bill.
And Bob, can we have you check in again? Your name.
I'm sorry. Yeah, for the record again, my name is Bob Nickel.
Thank you. Cameron?
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, following with Representative Cameron's question, I would like to know what the definition of unit here is. Is it just a room for the place, or for those who would be occupying as tenants, the chronically mentally ill, or doesn't a living unit, as is shown here, multiple, on line 16, multiple unit residential housing means housing that provides for two or more living units and spaces for common use by the occupants in social and recreational activity. When we talk about living units, doesn't that include both bathroom as well as kitchen?
Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, yes, it includes more than just the bedrooms, yes.
Okay, thank you. I needed to make sure that that was... So a duplex, which would normally have bedrooms, bathroom, kitchen, and perhaps a living area, some kind of a living area, would be one unit on one side, one unit on the other. Triplex would have three of those units that even though they might be two-bedroom, again, Bob, your preference was to maximize them, so you might have two people in a bedroom, but if they are seriously impaired by that, and that's a decision that you make professionally, then you might have a triplex, a six-bedroom triplex total, that would house five individuals and a manager, or four individuals and a manager's apartment in that process.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yes, this bill would allow us the flexibility to do all of the above.
Thank you very kindly.
Thanks, Representative Butler. Representative Greenlake.
Yeah, I just want to clarify that. You've used both the term residential unit and living unit, and I thought what you said was that triplex would be a single residential unit that might represent three or four living units. Is that...
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlake, this bill, as it's worded, would allow us to do a variety of those kinds of things. Residential, we usually use that term in conjunction with a licensed facility, which implies staff. And on some occasions, that staff is a live-in staff.
If I can follow up. We're asking a simple question, Bob. You have a triplex, and it has four people living in it. How many units is that? Is that one unit or is that four units?
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlake, I would consider that three units since it's a triplex. However, there could be more than three people living in it.
No, yeah. And a duplex would be two units then.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, that's my understanding.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greenlake. And thank you, Bob. And thank you very much, Representative Loken.
Thank you.
Great. Colleagues, we're going to bring Senate Bill 222 engrossed back on Wednesday for a work session added to the work sessions that we already have scheduled on that day. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 222 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 225. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 225 comes to us from the Senate. Senate Committee on Health Policy again. It passed the Senate floor with a 24-1 vote for excused and one legislative business vote. It modifies the scope of the immunization registry, which is maintained by the Department of Human Services. It modifies the requirements for documentation of the immunizations necessary for attendance at educational institutions in Oregon.
Thank you, Sandy. We have a couple of folks signed up to present, so we'll invite Lorraine Duncan and Paul Sislak, Dr. Sislak, forward. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lorraine Duncan. I'm the Immunization Program Manager for the Department of Human Services. And I'm here today to ask for your support on Senate Bill 225. This modifies the scope of our statewide immunization registry and additional requirements for college students. I'd like to give you a little bit of background about the statewide immunization registry, which is called ALERT. This registry was developed starting in the early 90s for the purpose of making sure that we had children's records combined into one record and that authorized users would have access to those records. Authorized users includes folks like schools, daycare centers, physicians' offices, health plans, people needing to look at children's immunization records. The purpose of having these records in one consolidated place is it helps keep kids in schools and daycare centers so they don't have to be excluded during the annual review and exclusion cycle. Currently, the registry has immunization records up through 18, and we do not have to get permission from those folks to share their record with an authorized user. That's for when they turn 18, however, we have to get permission from the person 18 and older in order to share their record with an authorized user. The information that we share with authorized users is very limited. It includes the person's name, their birth date, the date of their shots, and the actual shots that they got, and whether those shots came from a secondary source. So there's no information about demographics included in any information that's ever shared with an authorized user. Most information is shared via the web. There's a 24/7 website where people can go in and look up records. And then Monday through Friday from 8 to 5, we also have a hotline people can call and get information for immunizations. Colleges are particularly interested in having access to the alert immunization records. They also check on immunizations, and they felt it would be to their benefit, like for schools and daycare centers, to have access to that information. In 2002, we had two cases of measles at Oregon State University, and it caused a lot of work for the county health department and for the college to contain that outbreak. And it was hoped that additional requirements for international students could help address this. So this is an additional requirement facet of this bill. It clearly says that for students, international students coming from outside the country, that they have to have their measles before they start. The two cases of measles that we had, the students came from Japan, and they were incubating measles when they came. Most cases of measles anymore are imported, almost always. We don't have cases starting here in the United States. Most states like Oregon have kindergarten through grade 12 immunization requirements so that children are fully immunized by the time they attend college. Some of the Asian countries like Japan didn't have a measles requirement, and that's why they can come incubating measles into the country. The other thing that this bill does is looks at the no record exclusion order. We had a request from the Washington County School Nurses and the Multnomah Education Service District to consider that only health departments write no record exclusion orders. Currently, schools have the right to do that, but they find it burdensome and additional paperwork. So they're asking that only the health departments do that once a year during the annual review and exclusion cycle. So that's kind of a summary of the changes that are included in Senate Bill 225, and I appreciate your time for listening to this. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Duncan, had the alert system been fully up, functional and operational, you're telling us that at the campus of Oregon State University, when the two cases of measles broke out, that this would have substantially improved the ability to respond to the concerns of the campus. Tell us, can you be a little more specific about what the benefits would be in this particular instance?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, if the registry had included folks that are 18 or above, it would have allowed the school to go in and look up those records. As the statute currently allows for medical and religious exemptions, which means those children aren't protected in case of an outbreak. So there's always a number of folks that are susceptible to a disease, and that would have allowed the school to tell which ones they were in a very quick fashion. But since the registry wasn't allowed to do that without getting signed written permission, it was a little more difficult. I would like to clarify, though, that we started the registry back in 92, 93, and became fully operational in 1996. So obviously we started with the little ones, and as time goes on, we get more and more adults into the registry. So they probably all wouldn't have been in there, but some of them would have been in there.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
So Ms. Duncan, had the college had some kind of a waiver on their admission to have allowed them access to this, you wouldn't have a problem? Or has that waiver, has it been discussed? That when you're applying for entry into a public institution like this, that this ought to be an automatic waiver as opposed to having us come back and legislate it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Butler, that we hadn't considered that, and the College Health Association was the one that came to us this last year and just asked if we could make that change. They knew we were making other changes to the school immunization law, and they asked if we would do it at the same time.
Another follow-up, Mr. Chair?
A follow-up, please.
So if the Oregon University system put a waiver in for each applying student, that information could be made available without accessing, coming through this amplification of the alert registry, would it accomplish the same thing? Or could it accomplish the same thing today? And I'm not asking you to give a legal opinion, but I guess there's an easy way to do things, there's a difficult way to do things.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I'm not familiar with the waiver process, so I probably wouldn't be the right one to answer that question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Greenlink.
Yes, Paul, maybe you're the one to ask my question. I wonder why just requiring measles of the foreign students, and why not other diseases for which the other students have been immunized, I think immediately of polio, pertussis, perhaps, diphtheria. Why only measles?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Greenlick, for the record, I'm Dr. Paul Cieslak. I manage the Communicable Disease Program for the state of Oregon. It's an excellent question. The bottom line is we simply haven't seen outbreaks, clusters of reportable communicable diseases other than measles reported from our college campuses. As you're aware, there are a lot of communicable diseases that college students can get, hepatitis, meningococcal disease, but we simply haven't seen any clusters. Measles, on the other hand, we have seen clusters of illness, and they're virtually all imported. I've been manager of the Communicable Disease Program for about 10 years now, and all of the measles that has hit the Pacific Northwest during that time has been the result of importation. And on the one hand, we have a requirement now that that U.S.-born college students in our colleges are vaccinated against measles. We let slip through the cracks the one group that is bringing in measles, and so this requirement would now mandate that international students be vaccinated as well.
Thank you, Paul. Now, Paul, I understand why measles, but the field of public health talks about prevention, and the only place we're going to have, just as we've had that kind of impact with measles, certainly polio, pertussis, perhaps diphtheria, basically would only come from one of those foreign pools as well. So would the intention be to wait until you have an outbreak and then come for statutory approval, or do you think there's a possibility we might think ahead on this one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, I guess the truth be told, our general way of doing things is we look at our surveillance data, and if we're not seeing disease, then we don't throw a lot of resources at it.
Thank you. Thanks, Representative Greenlick.
Just a follow-up on the same thing. I mean, when you travel to many foreign countries, you're required to have immunization, so I don't know where you would take that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone, these are all excellent points, and I admit the possibility that these other diseases could be imported into Oregon. On the other hand, you know, polio is really not being transmitted in any of the developed countries of the world, which is where we get most of our foreign exchange students from, and I'm just not aware that it's much of a problem. Certainly, I'm sure there are cases of pertussis on college campuses, but on the other hand, we haven't been hearing reports of clusters that we would actually take a lot of public health action against, and it's sort of weighing the cost of adding another requirement to the benefit that we would see from it, and right now we're not seeing it.
But what is the outlook for pertussis? I know it's on the rise, at least here in Oregon.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thanks. It's an excellent question, and actually one of the reasons I wanted to speak in front of the committee, because I understand that there's a movement afoot to put a requirement for adolescent pertussis vaccination into statute, and I want to offer my opinion that I think that's a bad idea at this point. The number of reported cases of pertussis has been skyrocketing in Oregon over the last couple of years. We went from a baseline of around 60, 70 cases a year, and in 2004 we had 600 cases. So quite an astronomical rise. On the other hand, I think a lot of it is what we would call surveillance artifact. In other words, not a true increase in cases, but rather an increase that we're seeing more of them. About half of the cases that are reported now are being are called presumptive cases. They're not confirmed, but they're people with an illness that looks like pertussis who are linked to a confirmed case of pertussis. And these cases are basically shaken out of the trees by local health departments in their process of aggressively following up on known cases. So they find other people who look like they have pertussis, and they go into our reportable disease database. The other thing that's happened is that the testing has gotten much better. We used to have only culture. You have to stick a little swab through your nose all the way to the back of your throat and swab it and culture it. And that culture is thought to be 10 to 30% sensitive. It only picks up 10 to 30% of cases. Whereas now we have molecular techniques called polymerase chain reaction that is probably, you know, 3 to 5 times as good at picking it up. So I think a lot of the additional confirmed cases are because we have better testing methodology. Nevertheless, we're finding a lot more of it. I think it's true that there is a lot more out there than we ever suspected, and I now think that, you know, a lot of adults and adolescents who have that the cold that doesn't go away when you thought it should, the nagging cough that lasts 4 weeks instead of two, may well be pertussis. So we really look forward to getting an adolescent vaccine for pertussis, because I think adolescents and adults can really benefit from that kind of booster dose. Nevertheless, I would think it would be a bad idea to put a requirement for such a vaccination for adolescents in school into statute, because, first of all, the vaccine isn't licensed yet. There is no licensed vaccine right now for anybody over age 7. And secondly, because the company who's looking forward to getting one licensed hasn't set a price yet. And so we'd sort of be writing a blank check to this company that we'll pay whatever you charge to vaccinate our school children. I was horrified about 5 years ago when the National Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices recommended universal vaccination of children with the pneumococcal vaccine. It's a good vaccine. It's safe. It's effective. There's real disease out there. But they did it before the company set a price. And that made it part of the federal Vaccines for Children entitlement. So it's recommended, it's part of the entitlement. Now the company sets its price, and the price they set was $58 a dose. It's a four-dose series, and it doubled the cost of the entire childhood immunization schedule. So I think it would be a bad idea to do that before we know what it's going to cost.
Great. Thanks very much.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I just have to continue to express my angst and concern that we do through the regulatory process what I believe should be an immigration process, part of an immigration process, part of the process of bringing students in from foreign countries. They ought to be vaccinated. I mean, I can't get my kids into the first grade without a vaccination, and yet we can bring students from foreign countries into our universities, into our schools for that matter, without the necessary vaccines. And I'm going to guess that you probably couldn't get them into K-12 because they couldn't come into K-12 without the vaccinations. But they can in the Oregon University system, and they can in all of these other places where they have high exposure to lots of students. My concern is that we're doing legislation, we're authorizing legislation to do what you ought to be able to do in the university system with just part of it, and I say you, right, what we ought to be able to do in the university system with just a little more screening in that process and some of the requirements. So I'm very anxious about this overall process of now making records available. And it just isn't the health records that are concerning me. I have people that contact me on a regular basis, anxious about no contact with family members kinds of things, where their students attend public universities in the state of Oregon, and then a disaffected parent from another country or from another jurisdiction will come and have access and find out where that student is living and begin to try and attempt to recontact them. This just gives another avenue for them to be able to access additional information as to where that student might be through the alert system. And again, the state of Oregon's overall computer systems right now, our silos have demonstrated that they are not capable of really controlling and maintaining the information. They leak like sieves. And Health and Human Services is just as guilty as all the rest of them of not being able to maintain the information. And this, as I say, creates another avenue for people to gain access to information that they should not have. While I don't object to the information being maintained, particularly on our youngsters, I guess I'm anxious about it happening when they're over 18 years of age, creating a new database that creates more folks having access to it. And I think I'm going to express that opinion, Mr. Chair, with consternation and concern over this particular legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
Can I ask a question?
Representative Greenlee.
Is current address a data piece in the...
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, demographics, including current address, are included in the statewide immunization registry. But when we share information with authorized user, it's put on a completely separate server, and none of the demographics are included there. Also, when we get a request from a parent, we are glad not to share their information. So if they ask us not to share their information, it remains in the database, but we do not post it to the server where authorized users have access.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, panel, very much.
Thank you.
Bruce Fitzwater.
Chairman Dalto, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Fitzwater. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I represent the Christian Science Churches in Oregon. Though I mark myself down as against this bill, I really have to say that I support the primary intent of Senate Bill 225 and its endeavoring to make the state's programs more consistent and useful. But I do feel that this bill, as it's currently drafted, unnecessarily deletes from Oregon statutes an important element relating to the ethical and religious dimension of medical data banks. In this testimony, I want to briefly explain the desirability of a competent individual for him or herself making their personal choices about their health care, especially in regard to medical information about them in data banks. And I'm going to suggest some possible amendments to Senate Bill 225. As it was just stated by Representative Butler, we note that recent health care bills have taken into account some of the moral and ethical considerations arising out of the data banks and registries. There is clearly a growing concern throughout our society about compiled information about all aspects of people's lives. This morning on National Public Radio, I heard that the federal Department of Health Services was given an F for their protection of information on their computer systems, while the Nuclear Regulatory Division got a B+. So there's a considerable difference in government, and at this point, it's quite low in the healthcare. We feel that basically a person's medical data belongs to them, and that's the basis of our point here. Now, in that it belongs to them, they have the right to control that information. And that doesn't mean change it. It means that they can give it to whom they feel they want to and need to, and they should be able to then take it back from those who have it without their permission, just as you would anything else that you belong to. Now, we know that there's going to be exceptions to this for the individual's right to do this. And those exceptions are going to arise, particularly when there is an overriding public need for this information to protect others. However, in the current Oregon statutes, we have a provision that allows an individual over 18 to ask that their, by writing, that their information be purged. This is on section 3, page 3, line 29 of the drafted bill. This is being excluded from the present bill, and we feel that there's really no need for this at all. We're not objecting to the database as such, but we're objecting to the exclusion of the taking out of our law the right of an individual to step out and be purged from that system. Now, we understand that in some cases and the university. If an individual has not demonstrated that they have a immunization in place, this could result in some inconvenience for them. But it would be their choice to stand in that position.
Bruce, could I interrupt you for just a moment?
Yes.
Do we know why that purge provision is being excluded?
You'll have to. I've only spoken with Ms. Duncan on it briefly, and I didn't get a satisfactory answer from my standpoint.
Okay, we'll come back to that.
I feel that we do not need to eliminate this right, and I think even if it's somewhat more inconvenient, we should honor the right of privacy. Privacy is something that we have not thought a lot about in our society. We all have an individual feeling for it. And it relates to our, in a sense, deepest concepts of ourselves as individuals. I mean, what does it mean when somebody has information about you, gathers information about you? What difference would it make if someone was taping your conversations all the time on the telephone? What would you be actually losing? These are questions most of us have never really considered. Those of us who have religious objections to this, beyond the broad ones that are ethical in our society, feel that when an individual is holding, or a state is holding, information about one, beliefs about one, that this is, that are contrary to your deepest sense of identity, this constitutes in itself a kind of violation of your person and thought. We prefer for the state to have only that information it needs to protect other citizens. Not that's convenient, just to protect other citizens. And we realize that that may be leading us to situations where we have some discomfort in terms of, if there's an outbreak, then you may find yourself off the campus, etc. But we feel that's the individual's decision. So I have suggested on page 2 of the handout basically three possibilities for amendments, and there's a fourth one, which would be just to leave the present language in there that we have in there. The first would be the broadest. This would allow a client's parent or guardian who may request by writing the purging of the information record, a tracking record. The second would allow it only for people on the basis of his or her religious beliefs. The third point, I suppose, would be to leave it the way it is. And the fourth would be, and this came out of a discussion with Mrs. Duncan, that the provision that the state maintains, she used the language when I talked with her, and you can ask her, that this was not possible. If it's not possible, then at least we can not send the information. That is, a person can say, please do not send my information to the authorized users, which is the basis of this bill. We would not prefer that, but we certainly think it's better than having information moving around completely outside of a individual's control. I thank you for your attention to this, and I'd be glad to answer any of your questions.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for testifying, Mr. Fitzwater. You bring up some excellent questions. I'm just a little bit unclear about something you had said. I just want to make sure that I understand your position, that if a child, because of religious reasons, has reached 18 in the university, 17, I guess, would be in the university, and you would like that the fact that they did not receive an immunization, say, for what did we first talk? Measles. That information not be carried through to the university, might correct in understanding that?
Let's see. My position is sort of like a bullseye. I have mm-hmm. bigger circles and smaller circles. I'm not just interested in those who have religious objections. I'm interested in privacy of medical records for the whole society. And on the basis of that, then I feel that, just as a principle, any medical data that is not necessary for public health, that the individual should be allowed to give it to people and take it back from people. And in that sense, I hope that kind of answers what the situation would be there. In some cases, as you know, there is a provision for religious exemption from immunization.
Right.
And there is a statewide, a fairly small percentage of people who do that. And some of the people in my religion take advantage of that. And some of the children are not immunized. Some will go off to college then, and there is a similar provision at the state universities, at least as I am aware, that an individual actually does not have to be immunized if they have a religious objection. Now, they do carry a tremendous onus on that, in that when the back of the card, and I can't quote it for sure, but it says, boy, if there is an outbreak and you have to be taken off the campus, then we're not responsible for the economic consequences. We're not responsible for the academic consequences. You see. And I feel, this is another issue, that could certainly be softened, because these are not bad people. And I know, you know, people have gone through all the way to the university with all that emphasis. You see, that these are people who are on scholarships, are going through, and they would ruin their academic career. But they still say, no, this is more important to me, and so I'm going to hold to this.
So if I could follow up. So if I understand you correctly, then this, whatever this card is that has been signed, that the student did not have the measles vaccine.
This is for university?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
So you have no objection to that card, that notice, following that student throughout the years in university?
Chairman Dalto, Representative Tomei, I certainly don't fully understand how this works technically. My sense would be that it would just say that, you know, here is Jane Doe, mm-hmm. and what is her immunization? Nothing. We know anything about it. That's what it would say. It would say, we don't know if she's immunized or not. She has no proof of immunization. I would like to see it just unknown.
Okay, so I'm following up. When there is a known outbreak of measles, mm-hmm. and so Jane Doe has not had an immunization, mm-hmm. and somebody from Asia also does not have an immunization, this is a population, maybe a small population of people who have not been immunized. So the university will want to know that so that they can remove those students from the university so that they're not infecting. They're not going to be affecting each other. See what I mean? So isn't that information important for the university to have on both Jane Doe and on the Asian students?
Chairman Dalto, I see it the other way around. That is, that those students who have the immunization are not to be. That is, I would say, anyone who doesn't have that immunization should be dealt with, as opposed to having the specific information about it. I mean, I think that you have a student, and it says, we don't know the record. We have no record of this immunization. And that's all that would be there. That is, the student, the university would say, we have no record of immunization for Jane Doe. And you should be able to pull out in a computer that says, Jane Doe and, you know, Michiko Husahara both have immunization. Therefore, we're going to treat all those them the same, and they must be off campus. And then we understand that as a public health need and as an option. But it wouldn't really say she doesn't have it. It just would say we have no record, and without a record, everybody who doesn't have a record, off they go. We have no objection to that.
Thank you.
If that's the best public health policy.
Thank you. That helped clarify it for me. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Tomei. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So based upon what your recommendation is, Mr. Fitzwater, that basically an individual can give the information, i.e. while they're attending college, but then they can also take it back. That is, when they're either away from campus, graduated, or no longer attending, so that a student who has for religious reasons or other reasons has refused to take the inoculation of whatever kind, they just make no declaration whatsoever but then they suffer the consequences right along with the students who have indicated that they have not taken nor will they take those inoculations that in effect. And Mr. Chair, I see Mr. Fitzwater affirmatively shaking his head. Yes, my concern is, again, this is something that probably ought to be handled in the admissions process. I know that when I was a freshman at university, and as they were lining us up before we could receive our registration finalization, they lined us up and they put an air gun to your shoulder and said, "Hey, we're giving you a whole series of vaccinations." I said, "The devil you are!" They said, "Well, you can't be here without it." And I said, "Fine, I'm going home." So based upon that, until I could confirm to myself exactly what it was, and it wasn't done in a shoot kind of arrangement with the rest of the cattle in the registration, I felt like that I wanted to know exactly what was going on, and I found out that I had all of the things that they were going to give me in that particular MMR and all those other kinds of things as a freshman university. I had all of those. I didn't need them, and I didn't want them, and I wasn't going to stand up to that kind of thing. And I think that, again, Mr. Chair, it's much like what we've talked about in this committee before, relative to breast examinations and those kinds of things. The individual has some primary responsibility to take care of themselves. When we get the government, through a registry or other fashion, helping us take care of all of our needs from cradle to grave, and you don't have to worry about it, we'll worry about it, it becomes of rather great concern to me, and I think I favor Mr. Fitzwater's approach. That is, they can give the information or not give the information. They suffer the consequences when they do not give the information. But when they do tender the information to the university through the alert system, then they can draw it back when they leave. And I think I would much favor that approach rather than the wholesale slaughter of the whole system. Thank you, Mr.
All right. Representative Cameron.
Just a question for clarification. How is that same situation handled at the elementary level today?
Chairman Galto, Representative Cameron. Again, I'm not an expert on that subject specifically. There is if a parent or guard, as I understand it, and I'm in touch with people who exercise this, if a parent or guardian writes a note to the, I guess, usually it's the school itself, stating that the pupil is being raised in a religion in which this runs counter to their beliefs, they are exempted from, as far as I know, all of the immunization requirements at the present time. And it's been my experience that, on the whole, well, there's some communication questions about this at times, the school system and the Department of Public Health has been very, very amenable. They have been acceptable, and hasn't been tension that I'm aware of on this issue.
And thus, in the database that we're referring to, they wouldn't even show up?
You'd have to ask DHS, Chairman Dalton, Mr. Cameron, you'd have to ask them about that. I don't know.
Representative Greenlake?
Yes, this isn't precisely on Mr. Fitzwater's testimony, but I do want to comment. I've been pondering my friend Dr. Cieslik's comments. It does seem to me we ought to explore the notion of assuring that foreign students are immunized. I mean, it's great having foreign students at our university, and they really are very important to us, and they make the mix, but it is a privilege for a foreign student to come, and I think that we ought to require of our foreign students whatever immunizations we require of our K-12 students, or at least assure proof of that. And if we have a little time to explore that with Dr. Cieslik, I think it would be in our interest to do so.
Okay. Well, I tell you what we're going to do is we're not going to work on this on Wednesday. We're going to take a little time to try to explore some of the issues that were brought forward
thank you, Mr.
by the
Chair.
Testimony and
on the sensitivity.
You're welcome. I'm the part of the panel, so I guess we'll work with the department before we bring this back up. So thank you, Bruce, very much. And colleagues, is there anything else for the good of the order? Looks like we welcome the home care workers who are visiting us, but I think we just wrapped up, so.
The purple folks are here.
Well, the home care workers. Yes. Colleagues, we're going to bring back House Bill, well, we're going to try to bring back House Bill 2058 on Wednesday. Representative Crummell lost his mother, and Representative Crummell, we're not sure when he's going to rejoin us, but he has a vital role in that bill, so as soon as he rejoins us, we will work on that. And Representative Anderson had been tied up today in Judiciary on a bill, so he wasn't able to join us because I think they're still working on his bill. So with that, thanks very much. We'll adjourn the meeting. Yes.